This program is brought to you by McGill University. Please visit us at www.mcgill.ca.
And the Faculty of Science for inviting me. And I'd also like to thank Sir William Dawson, who isn't around to appreciate it, but he basically built this university. He was a natural scientist of the first order, and this building is full of his geological and other collections, as well as many others. So thank you, William Dawson, for producing the university, for providing this Victorian lecture hall to lecture in, and for being tolerant of the topic I hope you'll find acceptable rather than upsetting tonight. The picture you see was taken at the Basquetong Reservoir in northern Quebec on March 11, 1978. Jacques Lavoie and Richard Huot, both from Île Perrot, drove, parked, and hiked to the reservoir to look at some property that Lavoie was thinking of buying. They planned to camp out overnight near the lake and return the next day. They set up camp and lit a fire. Jacques went to gather more firewood when he saw a bright star moving slowly towards the lake. Then it dropped rapidly and hovered silently over the lake about 300 meters away. Lavoie was carrying a camera and had the presence of mind to take four photos, while Huot, who was also carrying a camera, simply stood transfixed. The UFO then moved off at what they called an unbelievable speed. Lavoie was afraid, and they decided to leave immediately. They packed their gear on their toboggan and started to hike back to their car. Lavoie turned around, looked behind him, saw the UFO still high in the sky, and that made them move even faster. They regained their car, stopped to rest and recover at a nearby restaurant, and then drove straight home to Île Perrot. The photos were developed by a professional photographer who was a friend of theirs. They were published in the Montreal Star newspaper and in the Montreal magazine. The original investigator, my colleague Vito Hoville, followed up the story after he saw the photos in the Star. He contacted Lavoie, who loaned him the original negatives and the original camera and provided the development details. In the summer of 1978, Hoville and I went to the reservoir with Lavoie's camera, found the spot at which the photos had been taken, and took a series of test photos to provide a basis of comparison with the original photo negatives. The original negatives and the test negatives were analyzed by Robert Lamarche, a McGill photo technician, on his own time. His analysis was definitive. There had been no artificial manipulation of the negatives. Based on image clarity and object superposition, our test photos served to locate the object at a distance of about 300 meters from the observers. Given the reaction of the observers and the proximity of the object, this observation is what is called a close encounter of the first kind, or CE1, using a terminology developed by J. Allen Hynek, a pioneer of UFO research. I'll talk more about him later. I'm starting with this example because, first, there were two witnesses. Second, the witness's story was consistent and was supplemented with several photos, only one of which you saw here. Third, there was competent technical support to analyze and evaluate the photo. And fourth, I helped to investigate the case. This is the first of many such cases that I will be discussing during these lectures. Here is the U.S. Air Force statement about unidentified flying objects. It is on their website at the URL on the slide, but you don't have to remember the URL. Just go to the official U.S. Air Force site, af.mil, search UFO, and this statement is what you come up with. No UFO reported, investigated, and evaluated by the Air Force was ever an indication of threat to our national security. There was no evidence submitted to or discovered by the Air Force that sightings categorized as unidentified represented technological developments or principles beyond the range of modern scientific knowledge, and there was no evidence indicating that sightings categorized as unidentified were extraterrestrial vehicles. How and why this policy statement came to be, I will discuss later on in this lecture. The statement is useful to the student of the UFO phenomenon because it is succinct and unequivocal and completely wrong. It is a statement of the exact opposite of what I intend this lecture series to demonstrate. First, that UFOs are so technically capable that national security is completely compromised and is dependent on their restraint. Second, that they embody a technology far beyond our modern scientific knowledge. And third, that they are extraterrestrial vehicles. I am a research psychologist by training and profession. Most of my work has been in the field of visual human perception, perceptual learning, and thinking. I retired from McGill's psychology department on September 1st of 2009 after 47 years of teaching and research, and I continue to consult and do applied research. I have been professionally interested in UFOs since 1966, although I was, of course, aware of them long before then because they were in the news as I was growing up. When I began to pay professional attention to the UFO media reports in 1966, they appeared to be consistent, although TV and newspapers are not the best place to get what you might call complete and consistent information. In fact, my reasoning wasn't much more sophisticated than, where there's smoke, there's fire. A lot of people seem to be seeing the same kind of thing, and so there's probably something there to see. In order to find out more, I joined a Washington-based organization called the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, NICAP, and because I was technically trained in a relevant discipline, NICAP sent me case reports for psychological evaluation. These were obviously much more detailed than what was reported in newspapers or on TV. Although some of the reports maybe questioned the reliability of the observers, the rest were incredible reports from credible witnesses, most containing much more detail even than the Baskaton case I've just shown you. From then on, I took up the question of UFOs as a matter of scientifically informed curiosity, basically asking myself, is the phenomenon more or less what it is observed to be? This is not a question whose answer was sought by very many of my fellow scientists, and I will explain why in the last lecture of the series. But the question intrigued me as a sideline to my research program in the theoretical and applied psychology of human visual perception. So this series of four lectures gives me the chance to synthesize and summarize what I have learned from a little more than 40 years' systematic, if secondary, attention to the phenomenon. But I am actually not here to discuss science. I'm here to discuss facts. The reason that I can discuss these UFO phenomena with authority is because my own scientific training puts me in a good position to analyze and comment on the facts. The facts are well known. They are correctly understood by many people, almost all of whom are not scientists. They are widely misunderstood by many other people, most of whom are scientists. So my lectures are intended as a scientifically based corrective to the widespread scientific misinterpretation of well-known facts about unidentified flying objects. The well-known facts are of two kinds. First, observations of unidentified flying objects, and second, the recall of remembered experiences of capture by extraterrestrials. I will talk about the UFO observations first and the capture experiences afterwards. Then I will talk about these facts in the context of the scientific enterprise as a whole, and finally discuss the social and political implications of these facts. Tonight, I'm going to review a set of four cases that give a broad picture of the phenomenon and of the kind of people who have been both experiencing it and studying it. Then I will take you through a chronology of the UFO phenomenon, starting in 1897 with the airships phenomenon and ending in 1981 with the publication of a book called Missing Time by the artist and writer Bud Hopkins. The other lectures will carry the chronology on from there. I will end the first lecture with the description of another UFO sighting, including occupants, by people of unquestionable integrity. One of them is a McGill University professor. In the second lecture, I will review other cases that give a comprehensive view of the UFO phenomenon. I will also discuss some of the protagonists in the UFO debate, including debunkers and skeptics. And since UFOs are embedded in popular culture, and because this series includes UFO-related movies, in fact, this is popular culture, I will also discuss the phenomenon from the point of view of popular rather than scientific culture. The third talk will be about close encounters, very close encounters, the UFO abduction phenomenon, which I have studied. I will review both the phenomenon and the research that I have carried out with my colleagues. In the fourth talk, I plan to discuss the complicated and sometimes antagonistic interface between the UFO phenomenon and science. My analysis is based on an important book by the philosopher of science, Thomas Kuhn, called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, published in 1962. Another reference point is a statistical tool called Bayes' theorem, originally published in 1764, which is fundamental to understanding both the cumulative effect of UFO evidence and also to explain why many scientists feel free to ignore it. Then I will discuss the work of the psychologist Leon Festinger, whose theory of cognitive dissonance explains the thought processes of people faced with unpleasant facts that contradict their established and strongly held beliefs. And finally, I will talk about the social and political implications of the UFO phenomenon. Now, here is a background of cases to provide some context for the entire phenomenon. This coin helicopter incident, which occurred on October 18, 1973, was investigated and reviewed by Jenny Zeidman of the Chicago-based Center for UFO Studies. I'm a member of it, by the way. A U.S. Army Huey helicopter left Port Columbus, Ohio, at about 10:30 p.m. for its home base in Cleveland, a distance of about 100 miles. Its Army Reserve crew had flown south to Columbus for a routine medical examination. The command pilot was Captain Lawrence J. Coyne, with 19 years flying experience. First Lieutenant Arrigo Jezzi, a chemical engineer, was at the controls. Two other crew members were Sergeant John Healy, 35, a Cleveland policeman, and Sergeant Robert Janicek, 23, a computer technician. The helicopter was cruising at 2,500 feet above sea level at 90 knots over hilly terrain, averaging about 1,200 feet in elevation. The night was clear and the air was calm, with the last quarter moon just rising. About 10 miles south of Mansfield, Ohio, Sergeant Healy noticed a single red light off to the west, moving south. About 2 minutes later, a little past 11 p.m., Sergeant Janicek noticed a single red light to the southeast, which he eventually brought to Captain Coyne's attention. Coyne glanced over, noted the light, assumed it was distant traffic, and told Janicek to keep an eye on it. 30 seconds later, Janicek said that the light was on a collision course with the helicopter. Coyne took over the controls from Jezzi and put the Huey into a powered descent at 500 feet per minute. Coyne tried to radio the Mansfield control tower because he thought the unknown might have been an Air National Guard F-100 based in Mansfield. He couldn't make radio contact on any frequency, and a follow-up showed there was no F-100 in the air. The red light stayed on a collision course. Coyne increased his rate of descent to 2,000 feet per minute and his airspeed to 100 knots. Just before it reached and collided with the helicopter, the light stopped and hovered ahead and above it. A featureless, metallic, cigar-shaped domed object filled nearly the entire front windshield. It was visible against a background of stars. The red light came from the front, a white light was seen at the rear, and a green searchlight beam shone from the after part of the object. The searchlight beam passed over the helicopter nose, up through the helicopter windshield, and enveloped the cockpit in green light. After an estimated 10 seconds of hovering, the object accelerated to the west and then disappeared north towards Lake Erie. There was no noise or turbulence during the encounter, except a bump was felt as the object accelerated away. As the object left, the magnetic compass in the helicopter was rotating at about 4 times per minute. The altimeter read 3,500 feet, and the helicopter was climbing at 1,000 feet per minute, even though the control lever, the collective, was still directing the helicopter downwards. Coyne eventually regained flight control, returned to 2,500 feet, and continued on to Cleveland. On the ground, near where the helicopter met the UFO, Mrs. E.C. and four adolescents were driving east when they saw two bright lights, red and green, descending towards them. Then the lights slowed and moved to the right of their car when the family heard and saw the helicopter approaching from the southwest. Mrs. E.C. stopped the car. Two people got out and saw both the helicopter and the object, which they said looked like a blimp and was sort of pear-shaped and as big as a school bus. The object appeared as big as a 100-millimeter cigarette box held at arm's length. They saw it hover over the helicopter, and they estimated the distance at 500 feet away and about 500 feet up. The object's green light made everything, the helicopter, the trees, the road, the car, turn green. This encounter was documented in the flight records of the aircrew filed after landing, by interviews with the aircrew once the reports had become public, and by investigators who found and interviewed the ground witnesses to the helicopter UFO encounter. The next investigation was carried out by James E. McDonald, an atmospheric physics professor from the University of Arizona. In July 1957, a U.S. EC-47 on a practice mission from Kansas over the Gulf of Mexico, encountered and recorded a persistent UFO which followed the aircraft for hundreds of miles. The EC-47 was an electronic countermeasures aircraft filled with radar, radar receivers, and radar jammers. It was as well equipped as any piece of flying equipment to record the electronic signature of a UFO. It was crewed by 6 officers, 3 pilots, and 3 electronic warfare specialists. As the EC-47 was returning from the first part of its mission over the Gulf of Mexico, the pilot saw a bright light and the electronic specialist recorded a radar signal that coincided with the location of the light. The light and the signal kept pace with their aircraft for hundreds of miles. This would be called a radar visual contact, and it's one of the categories developed by J. Allen Hynek, a distinguished UFO researcher, which we'll talk about later. For part of the time, the light and the radar signal kept a position off to the right and slightly ahead of the aircraft. Then, once back over the continent, and after clearing the maneuver with both the Federal Aviation Authority and local air defense radar centers, the pilot abandoned his flight plan, went to full power, and tried to chase the UFO. As the plane gained on it, it suddenly dropped hundreds of feet and came to a stop, a mid-air stop, causing the EC-47 to overshoot the target. Again, with permission, the EC-47 made a tight turn and went after the UFO, but this time the UFO maneuvered behind the aircraft and sat on its tail. The UFO was picked up by ground radar, which could distinguish between the EC-47 and the UFO because the EC-47 had turned on its IFF identification transmitter, which is a system that sends out a clear signal about a friendly aircraft to radars intercepting it. Finally, the EC-47, running low on fuel, turned for home, and the UFO, instead of following it home, disappeared from both ground and airborne radar screens. McDonald found the original communication transcripts and interviewed the airborne participants of this event to complete a summary that appeared in one of the few scientific books about UFOs. The book, UFOs, A Scientific Debate, was the record of a symposium on unidentified flying objects held at the American Association for the Advancement of Science meeting in Boston in December of 1969. Over the period from 1983 to 1990, across southeastern New York State and western Connecticut, there were repeated eyewitness reports at night of large, low, slowly moving triangular or boomerang-shaped craft. These sightings were reported in local newspapers and on local radio stations. Law enforcement officers saw them and photographed them. Local observers sketched what they saw. The sightings occurred up and down the Taconic Parkway, a beautiful divided highway that runs up the east side of the Hudson from above New York City to Albany. The reports were documented in a comprehensive book called Night Siege, The Hudson Valley UFO Sightings, written by J. Allen Hynek, Philip Embergrino, and Bob Pratt, and published in 1998. Now, this story has a kind of personal twist as well. Fernando Nottebohm is a Rockefeller University neuroscientist whose research focuses on the behavior and the brain mechanisms involved in bird song. Rockefeller University is in New York City. Nottebohm lives north of the city along the Taconic Parkway. He gave a talk in the psychology department at McGill sometime in the late 80s or early 90s. It was during the period of the Taconic Parkway sightings. After his talk, I asked Professor Nottebohm if he'd sighted any of these things while commuting up and down the parkway. Yes, he said, he had seen them, but he thought that they had been explained away as some kind of natural or artificial phenomenon. This is a remarkable and revealing insight that demonstrates the restricted intellectual focus of a highly competent and respected modern scientist. It is quite like the remark made about UFOs by Albert Einstein and quoted by David Jacobs in his book on the history of the UFO controversy in America. Einstein said, "These people have seen something. What it is, I do not know, and I am not curious to know." The facility with which both Professor Einstein and Professor Nottebohm could turn off their scientific imagination will be discussed in the context of both the psychology and the philosophy of science during the last lecture in this series. The next case is based on the observations of Canadian witnesses at 4 locations along the Klondike Highway in the Yukon on December 11, 1996. It was investigated by Martin Jasek, a BC-based professional engineer, and he reported it in a booklet called Giant UFO in the Yukon Territory, which was published by UFOBC, a UFO organization, in 2000. Jacek was able to personally interview 22 of the 31 witnesses who reported having seen the object. The most important sightings were at Fox Lake, where witnesses reported a gigantic, low-flying object that in one case flew almost directly over a stopped car. In another case, the UFO passed over a trapper in the woods, and the object was eventually reported by 31 observers as it moved over a distance of about 200 miles past a string of Yukon settlements along the highway. Here an observer spreads his arms apart to show how big the object appeared from his vantage point along the Klondike Highway next to Fox Lake. This slide is a reconstruction of the object, created from sketches made by the witnesses. Most of the observations located the object relative to both the observer and the background, buildings, lake, nearby hills, and so the distance to the UFO, as well as its apparent size, could be estimated. The average of 6 independent witness estimates of apparent distance and apparent size produces a UFO diameter of an average 1.5 kilometers, with a range of estimates from 0.9 kilometers to 2 kilometers. Now you have seen some points of reference about what some of what people have seen, recorded, and reported about UFOs. To consolidate what you've seen, all of these cases are multiple witness cases. Several of them are expert witness cases in the sense that the people seeing the objects or reporting them have technical training in the fields and a professional position in the military, which would make them very loath to jeopardize their reputation by misbehaving and being disingenuously reporting these things. The other witnesses were numerous. There were photographs, sketches, drawings, and independent reports from both the Yukon and the Night Siege sightings. I'm going to review now some of the milestone events that have taken place in the UFO chronology, because even though you've seen these sets of sightings and you've had an introduction to the phenomenon, you probably don't have a sense of how long this has been going on and what's been happening over the course of basically a little over a century, during which people have paid attention one way or another to this phenomenon. I can only discuss each event briefly because many of the landmarks in this slide are in fact books that summarize an approach, a complex investigation, or an era. And to do justice to each would require reading each or discussing each event in depth. This might do for a 3-credit reading course, but it won't do for a series of short lectures. And incidentally, if you haven't got them already, I have more reading lists which people are welcome to take away without having to worry about filling out an exam afterwards. In the late 19th century and early 20th century, a phenomenon called the airships phenomenon was prevalent throughout the newspapers in the United States and to some degree in Europe. At this point, lighter-than-air dirigibles were in the air and being experimented on. Heavier-than-air flight was still just a dream. Many reports appeared in newspapers. Many were probably inventions of the people who either told the reporters the invented stories or reporters themselves who made them up. And it's too long ago to be sure. But some of the more sketchy accounts still sound like some of the reports that have occurred during the last century with somewhat better documentation and better witnesses. But that's simply a beginning. What happened in 1944, during the Second World War, both Allied and Axis flyers reported small luminous balls of light flying in formation with their own aircraft. And each side thought these were military inventions of the other side. Nobody ever figured out what they were. They weren't the kind of plasma discharges we'll talk about later. But the reports were simply filed and forgotten. The war was over, and that was the end of it. Until after the war, in 1946. The beginning of the modern UFO era was really 1946, when ghost rockets were seen over Sweden and other Scandinavian countries. Seen both in daylight and at night, these were often cigar-shaped, metallic-looking objects, if they were seen in daytime, traveling at moderate to high speeds and brightly luminous at night. This was at the beginning of the Cold War, and one theory was that they represented a development of German rocket technology carried out by the Soviets with captured German scientists. This was taken seriously enough so that high American defense officials, including the Secretary of Defense at the time, visited Sweden to talk to Swedish authorities about what they'd seen and reported. The Soviet technology theory was disproved for a variety of reasons, and the reports were simply filed away. These observations, reported as they were systematically by trained observers in Sweden, as well as amateur observers, constitute the starting point of the modern history of UFOs. But the American, the North American beginning was really the Kenneth Arnold sighting, which is, if you like, in an epidemiological sense, the index case for UFO events. On June 24th, 1947, Kenneth Arnold, who was a private pilot and a respected local businessman, was flying near Mount Rainier in Washington State. He observed 9 bright objects flying between his plane and the nearby mountains. And by measuring the time it took them to pass between peaks whose distance apart was known, Arnold was able to estimate their airspeed at about 1,700 miles an hour, which was, of course, impossible for aircraft technology of the day. He also mentioned to a reporter that they seemed to move like a flat rock skipped across the water. Arnold did not call them flying saucers, but an unknown headline writer first coined the phrase, which was then adopted by almost everyone else to describe what was seen in the many, many UFO reports that followed Arnold's first sighting in that summer of 1947 flying saucer flap. Then we come to the U.S. Air Force, or at the time the U.S. Army Air Force, which became shortly afterwards the U.S. Air Force. Press interest, as well as interest from within the Air Force, which was being transformed from a part of the Army to becoming an independent service, led to a bureaucratic response to the 1947 sightings. An Air Force project to collect evidence and pass on estimates of its importance to superior officers in the Air Force intelligence hierarchy. During the 40s and 50s, there were 2 schools of thought within the Air Force. What you might call the liberal school maintained the extraterrestrial hypothesis as a possibility, but not a certainty, while the conservative school considered all reports to be misidentifications of natural or man-made phenomena, and they also believed that studying UFOs was a waste of time and money. So the Air Force data collection effort had a spotty history. It was either run by a usually low-ranking officer who took his mandate seriously under a liberal boss, or it was run by a low-ranking officer who knew that his unsympathetic boss expected him to explain everything away as a misperception. And so it went from 1948 through 1969. The projects were respectively named Grudge, Blue Book, or Sign, Grudge, and Blue Book. Into the midst of this came the man whose name is most closely associated with the early days of UFO study in America, Dr. J. Allen Hynek. Hynek was a University of Ohio astronomy professor whose proximity in Columbus, Ohio, to the Wright-Patterson Airfield in Dayton, the headquarters of the Air Force's Foreign Technology Intelligence Division, responsible for the UFO studies, made him the obvious candidate to advise the Air Force on the possible natural causes of UFO sightings. Hynek worked in that capacity from 1948 until 1969, when he finally resigned in protest about what he thought was the inadequate handling of UFO data by the Air Force. He wrote his own book on the subject in 1972, The changes of project name from Sign to Grudge to Blue Book actually do reflect, to some extent, the Air Force's attitude changes to the problem over that period of time. In 1950, the project was taken over by a reserve Air Force captain called back to serve during the Korean War, Donald Ruppelt, who was a liberal on the subject and under whose direction Project Blue Book was actually vigorously and intelligently pursued. But in 1952, there were many sightings in and around Washington, D.C., even in areas near the White House and Capitol that are prohibited to private and commercial flights. This so-called flap again mobilized public interest in UFOs, made it clear that the Air Force could neither explain the sightings nor defend Washington airspace against intruders and embarrass the U.S. military establishment. The CIA was brought in to consider the relationship between UFOs and national security. They convoked a panel of Washington scientific insiders to decide what to do about it. The Robertson panel, named after its chair, CIA scientist H.P. Robertson, decided that UFOs were not a national security threat, but that UFO hysteria was, mainly because the U.S. air defenses at the time still included a ground observer corps, people who looked for enemy aircraft in the skies. If UFO reports were maliciously made by foreign agents, it might distract the ground observer corps from their vigilance against Soviet bombers and lead to a successful surprise attack. So the Robertson panel formulated a debunking policy. UFO data were to be surreptitiously collected by the Air Force, as it had been doing all along. But every public statement made by any government spokesman about UFOs would deny their existence and explain away sightings as caused by natural or man-made phenomena, regardless of whether or not the explanation fit the data. A spate of UFO books followed. Harvard astronomer Donald Menzel was a leading debunker, and two of his books, which are listed here, provided a meteorological, astronomical, or psychological explanation for every sighting and derided the people who took a public position that the sightings were of unknown phenomena. Even my own field was scratched a bit by this, because Paul Fitz, a very distinguished human factors psychologist with many military and Air Force connections, joined the debunkers and was quoted as saying, sightings are the results of misperceptions. Edward Ruppelt, we last met running Project Blue Book as an Air Force reserve captain, which again gives you some idea of how important the project was in the Air Force military hierarchy. After he had finished his tour of duty, Ruppelt wrote a book about his experience, in which he details many of the most interesting cases he investigated, interviewing pilots and intelligence officers at Air Force bases across the country, as well as describing Air Force politics during the 5 years that he was on active duty supervising the project. Journalist John Fuller wrote two excellent books. Incident at Exeter is his narrative investigative account of a series of low-level UFO sightings near Exeter, New Hampshire, in 1965. The Interrupted Journey is his account of the Barney and Betty Hill abduction case, the first well-known abduction, and one I will discuss during the third talk. The RAND Corporation, RAND stands for Research and Development, was set up as a private company after the Second World War to continue to provide U.S. government agencies, mainly the defense establishment, with scientific and technological advice, research and development expertise in areas of national interest. In 1968, RAND researcher George Coker, who had investigated sightings himself and who had done a good deal of research on the subject, wrote an internal RAND document titled, UFOs, What to Do? His conclusion? Organize an open, nationwide data gathering system in order to obtain more than the even fragmentary and unsystematic data that had been collected by the best organized parts of Project Blue Book. This, of course, was a viewpoint opposite to that of the Robertson panel, which had established a national debunking strategy that drove the Air Force UFO collection system, and of course it was never implemented. In 1968, the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Science and Technology and Astronautics held a symposium on unidentified flying objects, which was printed and distributed by the U.S. Government Printing Office. The symposium received and published papers invited in advance by a range of scientists, including both debunkers and serious students of the phenomenon. It also heard testimony from six people, including Professor Hynek, Professor James E. MacDonald, Professor Carl Sagan, all of whom we will hear about later. In 1969, the American Association for the Advancement of Science held a UFO symposium at its annual meeting in Boston. Again, both debunkers and students of the phenomenon attended, and the papers and lectures were published shortly afterwards in a book called UFOs, A Scientific Debate, edited by Carl Sagan and Thornton Page. The U.S. government position on UFOs, first adopted by the Robertson Commission in 1962, was confirmed by the Commission of Inquiry established at the University of Chicago, Colorado, because I went to the University of Chicago and I don't think they ever would have done that. Established at the University of Colorado under contract to the Air Force in 1966. The commission met for 18 months and issued a report called Scientific Study of Unidentified Flying Objects. Reading the substantive chapters of this report and then reading the conclusion is like hearing about exit polls from the Iranian election and then reading the official response. They just don't match. Edward U. Condon, the commission chairman, was a debunker from the beginning. Condon wrote the report's conclusions and recommendations, which were that, quote, further extensive study of UFOs probably cannot be justified in the expectation that science will be advanced thereby, unquote. Condon concluded that all but an insignificant minority, and said that all but an insignificant minority of reports could be explained as natural phenomena or psychological phenomena, meaning misperceptions of ordinary objects. In fact, investigators following up new leads and reviewing old cases for the commission decided that about one-third of the cases that they investigated were unknowns, meaning that there was enough information about them to rule out any other known cause, including psychological. In other words, one-third of their cases were UFOs, rather than flying objects known to be something else. J. Allen Hynek, whom we met as the Air Force's astronomer assigned to Project Blue Book, finally resigned from the position in 1969 and went public with his objections to the Air Force handling of the evidence and his disagreement with the conclusions of the Condon Commission. He wrote The UFO Experience, A Scientific Inquiry in 1972. Hynek died in 1986. I had the good fortune to meet him before he died. David Jacobs is a Temple University history professor whose PhD thesis at the University of Wisconsin became The UFO Controversy in America, a scholarly account of the phenomenon up to that time. Jacobs is still an active researcher in the abduction field. The late Donald Menzel we have heard of before. His third debunking book took the same tack as the others, attributing all observations of every kind to astronomical or atmospheric phenomena and human misperception. Finally, Bud Hopkins is a widely exhibited New York sculptor and painter. He, with a group of friends, saw a UFO over Cape Cod in the early 1960s. After a couple of more exposures to UFO-related accounts from friends and acquaintances, he wrote an article on one case that he had heard of and investigated for the Village Voice newspaper in New York. Being one of a very few reasonably comfortable, well-connected people who took the phenomenon seriously, and not being in any way connected with the scientific establishment, he was able, on his own time, to write a best-selling account of several abduction situations in a 1981 book called Missing Time. As a result of his interest and his media exposure, Hopkins, along with David Jacobs, became a leading researcher into the abduction-related aspects of the UFO phenomenon, and has written three more books on the topic since then. I have collaborated with Hopkins on abduction research, and I will discuss that research in the third lecture. The outline stops here because this gives us a jumping-off point from which to deal with the phenomenon in the next three lectures. You now have a sense, a very quick survey, of the North American background of the 20th century UFO phenomenon, and my plan is to explore forward from here in the next lectures. But here is another side of the UFO story, and it explains why the UFO phenomenon has had such a mixed press. Since the very first sightings in 1947, a variety of quasi-religious and cult groups have formed with the existence of extraterrestrials as a central focus. Some are harmlessly nutty, as in the photograph. Others tragic, like the Heaven's Gate community of 39 people who committed mass suicide in 1997 so they could change their plane of existence and be taken aboard a UFO that was supposed to be following in the wake of the Hale-Bopp comet. Now, many people organize their lives around beliefs about another plane of existence. I mention crucifixion and resurrection, heaven and hell, to explain the context of that statement. People who think that UFOs mean extraterrestrials simply have a new hypothesis on which to base a religion. People who make religious extrapolations from that hypothesis may be just as accurate or just as inaccurate as those who make religious extrapolations from the hypothesis of superior, redemptive, angelic, or demonic extraterrestrials without the accompanying UFOs. Finally, here is another personally investigated case. In 1977, Vito Hoville, who started the Baskaton Reservoir investigation, went to Ottawa to look through the Canadian National Research Council non-meteoric sighting file. This was a publicly accessible, paper-based data source formerly maintained by NRC. It was, for a while, a repository of sighting reports that could not be confirmed as meteorites, but that had made their way to the NRC from local authorities, local police, the RCMP, or the Canadian military. Hoville found a letter from the wife of a McGill University professor, whom I happen to know. The letter described a close encounter UFO sighting and asked NRC for an explanation. An explanation was forthcoming. The return letter explained that she had seen a low-flying DC-9 approaching the Ottawa airport. I approached the professor in question and asked him about the sighting. He invited my wife and I to dinner, and after dinner they told us the full story with increasing agitation and emotion. And here it is. In the summer of 1973, the professor and his family were returning to Montreal along Ontario Route 17 from a visit that had taken them west of Ottawa. The professor was driving. There was a child in the back seat, and the professor's wife was sitting in the front passenger seat. As they approached Ottawa at dusk, the professor's wife noticed a low-lying, very bright light, or very bright star. She thought about the comet Kahute, which had been located several months before. As they drove past Ottawa, she kept her eye on it and noticed that the object appeared to be moving. She mentioned it to her husband, whom she said didn't respond. He didn't comment on that when that was repeated in the interview. Then it took on a different appearance. It came closer to the horizon and appeared to be moving slowly towards them. As it approached, it changed from a point source to a round light that seemed to shine out and illuminate a round metallic object. Her new theory was that it was an illuminated water tower and that she had been wrong about it moving. But then the object moved even closer, and as she said, there was nothing under it, nothing holding it up. She said that it came within 100 feet of the road. There was no sound. As it approached, the sides opened up to expose large windows that emitted an even stronger light. She said to her husband, "It looks like a flying house." According to their story, it went straight up over the car and disappeared behind them as they continued to drive to Montreal. From the time of her water tower hypothesis to the time it flew up and over the car, she estimated that about 5 seconds had passed. Her husband recalled that the object was spherical and that the light emanating from it was blindingly bright. He also said that he thought he saw figures behind the windows, and as he described it, "These people just came over our heads." The husband said that he thought the object was as big as two good-sized two-story houses. The professor, who had been a military pilot, realized that this was not an airplane, but a UFO. In fact, it was what is called a close encounter of the third kind, a UFO with humanoids. Francis Parkman is the great historian of the early French, English, and Indian conflicts in North America. In the course of his scholarly researches, he presented a perspective on the events of those times that did not always agree with the existing scholarship. He expressed his respect for the scholars and public figures with whom he disagreed in the following terms. "I can think of no better expression for my own attitude towards the people who might disagree with me and towards the facts that I have presented tonight and that I plan to present over the next three lectures in this series. Some of the results here reached are of a character which I regret, since they cannot be agreeable to persons for whom I have a very cordial regard. The conclusions drawn from the facts may be a matter of opinion, but it will be remembered that the facts themselves can be overthrown only by overthrowing the evidence on which they rest, or by bringing forward counter-evidence of equal or greater strength, and neither task will be found to be an easy one. Thank you. I think I'm allowed to answer questions now, unless Ingrid objects, so I will. Yes?
Nobody's ever died from UFOs, so why worry about it?
I'm not worried. I'm just recording.
I'm an engineer. Yeah. How can you say you've got the facts, but you haven't got the science? You don't care about the science.
I don't care about the science. I have the facts. As a scientist, I'm telling you that these facts are not psychological aberrations.
But you're in the psychology department, that's in the faculty of science.
That's true.
So?
Well, where are we here? We've got facts. I'm comfortable with the facts. My professional expertise leads me to be certain that these facts are not the result of misperceptions of ordinary phenomena by misguided people. Yes?
I can understand why the facts would be like the last quotation, but many times you seem to go from these established facts to describing the details of an extraterrestrial society.
I haven't said a thing about an extraterrestrial society. I've said in my introduction that by the time we've finished the series of lectures, I hope to have persuaded you that these are technologically advanced objects, that they, in some sense, constitute a threat to national security, and that they are extraterrestrial. I haven't finished the series yet. Yes?
Have there been any sightings from China or India or non-North American, non-European places?
Yes, there are. Any other questions? Yes?
Okay. I was wondering, before you started studying these close encounters, were you yourself a skeptic of the UFOs, or were you fairly open-minded?
I would say I've been fairly open-minded for my entire life, because UFOs as a phenomenon started when I was 10 years old, basically. And it's not, they're obviously not anything new. And they're, the existence of a phenomenon goes so far back that the process or the phenomena has been omnipresent for most of my life, or a good part of it anyway. So I would say I've been open-minded, if you want to call it that, for all this time. I'll tell you why there are skeptics later on, and the psychological mechanisms that turn people into skeptics or debunkers are pretty well understood, especially natural scientists. And that I'll get to in Lecture 4, but I promise you some resolution on that issue.
Do you wish you'd seen one yourself?
Not especially. I'm not a worrying kind of person. I'm certainly not going out of my way. I take that back. During one of the earlier flaps, I took my son and myself up to the top of Mount St. Hilaire, which is a McGill property, as you probably know, out in the, well, just about 25 miles to the southeast, and stood up there all night seeing if I could see anything in the sky. It was a nice night to go on a overnight camping trip. We did. We saw some lights coming up the mountain. It turned out to be a party of laser surveyors who were doing some surveying for the Quebec government. But we didn't see any UFOs. Yes?
I noticed a lot of references, it's either engineers or IT guys or pilots.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's just as many or more so from, you know, Billy Joe Bob, who lives in the country and has very little credibility. Are you deliberately concentrating more on the people with scientific credibility than just...
Yes, for the very good reason that I want to persuade you that these things actually are there. And if I use as a sample of cases, a sample provided by witnesses whose credentials, if you want to call them that, social credentials, are high, then I'm less likely to run into skeptics who say Billy Joe Bob can't be believed because he's just a country bumpkin. Now, I'm not...
I know, I mean, 99% of my friends are engineers, and
yeah.
You have to...
I understand. Yes, but when they see it, engineers are better than scientists. Engineers are far better at believing what they see than theoreticians are. You turn the tap on, they see the water come out. They say, yeah, water comes out of the tap. The theoretician says, it doesn't matter what you tell me, the tap is not connected, the water can't come out. You see the difference? That difference turns up time and time again, because many of these observations come from technically competent people in the aerospace engineering or aerospace field.
Do you think if government are not speaking about it, that's not because they don't trust about it, but just because they want to hide it?
I've given you the evidence I have about their motivations, which is the now public deliberations of the Robertson panel, in which it was decided that a debunking policy would be deliberately followed by the U.S. Air Force as the official agency of the U.S. government in 1952. That policy hasn't changed since. Now, that's all I can say. I don't know any more than that. That it was started deliberately.
Because there is witnesses from a long time, from the Roman people, they was describing flying Tipeus.
If you look through historical literature, you can find references to things that people might consider as UFOs in historical paintings and historical manuscripts and so forth and so on. I haven't dealt with that simply because I can't deal with everything, and I'm trying to stick to things that are more observable and, if you like, recordable. Other governments, and we'll see that in upcoming lectures, in particular Lecture 2, have been more forthcoming than the U.S. government, quite a bit more. Yes?
Just to touch upon the whole idea, and I'm sure you'll be touching upon it in other lectures,
But the Condon report, which was released by the Air Force, was actually meant to debunk a lot of the UFOs that were being seen by the U.S. government. And it was in relation to the Project Blue Book.
Yes, that's right.
So there's definitely a Condon report that states that UFOs should be debunked, that there should be no investigation put further. And that's actually the basis at which the government, especially NASA and the U.S. government, are following.
Well, that's true. As I said, sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, but the second part I wanted to know, I just wanted to ask if you, what you think of the NASA footage, a lot of the NASA footage, the Tether incident, a lot of other incidents that NASA has photographed, because I'm sorry I missed most of your lecture, but I have been following the UFO phenomenon for quite a while, and I find there's way too much evidence in terms of NASA footage that shows that there's definitely craft, if you will,
yeah,
that are orbiting the planet, and especially the space station.
I agree with you, and I've seen that footage, and I've seen it described in various sources. I only didn't mention it because there were more immediate sources to talk about. Several astronauts and several photographic records report something like nocturnal lights, or even craft with angular subtents in the air. Yeah, I know that. Yes?
Interesting to say that the director of the NASA, for example, Apollo mission, was von Braun, and von Braun was the guy who was supposed to create the real Aonebu flying object for the German people.
Oh, you're talking about, yeah. There are, again, I'm going to get to that in the next lecture, but there are terrestrial craft that look like UFOs. Some of them developed in Germany at the end of the Second World War. Some of them developed in the United States about the same time. But that's coming. That's coming. Yes?
What did you think of that footage from Norway a couple of weeks ago and the Russians claiming that it might have been a missile?
Didn't see it.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
It was all over CNN and so forth. That's why.
I missed that. I think I recall some reference to a cloud of light or something like that. But I didn't. I have no details. Yes?
Are you going to be drawing the parallel between seeing an unidentified flying object in the sky and abduction phenomenon, how the two are completely different? I'm going to be
talking about both of them, yes.
Right,
wait and see.
Are you going to establish that there's a distinct separation between the two? Or
wait and see.
We should let them know the dates.
Oh, yes, please.
The next one is the 29th of January.
That's right.
In 2 weeks. That one is entitled UFO Abductions, and we'll use the film Communion. And I think that's the day you're scheduled to be on Radio Noon.
It's the 28th.
The day before. So you can ask him questions that didn't get answered tonight. Then the next one is February 12th.
Right.
Close Encounters, followed by the recent Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And the final one is end of February.
It's 2 weeks after that one.
Yeah.
So it's the
27th of February, and that film will be Contact, the Jodie Foster film, based on the Carl Sagan book.
Right.
So there's lots to come. I'm sorry I'm rushing things, and I know you have lots of questions. Dr. Dondery has promised to answer any more questions after the film. We're going to start the film. It's the 1955 film, the very first Invasion of Body Snatchers. It's black and white. McGill buys our titles and buys the public performance rights for us to show them here. We're going to take a 10-minute break. I'll start the film at 6:15. Normally, we're not supposed to eat or drink in here, so you haven't heard this, but if you're going to go and get a pizza or anything, and tuck it under your coat, we're going to be having a film night with snacks tonight. Unidentified.
Your last slide was on chronology there. It stopped in 1981.
Right.
So you're going to describe things from 1981 till now? For 30 years.
Right.
That's why you didn't put it on chronology.
Okay. You're welcome.
That was the
important because they're there. Your father was a river pilot. That's a fascinating one. Ten more river pilots.
Yeah.
Okay, what's your last name? What's his name?
What's he?
In your research, have you ever come across any documented cases of objects actually penetrating the atmosphere, coming in the atmosphere, or have they all been within?
There's a large controversial history about radar targets on the anti-ballistic missile radars that were set up from the 50s on. So-called uncorrelated targets are inputs to the system that whose trajectories don't compute as landing on some space without protected territory. And the system tracks and rejects what's been done, and there is no doubt that there are lots of those so-called uncorrelated targets that are on earthbound trajectories from space. But what evidence has been retained of those? I don't know. I'm not privy to that information.
I just wanted to know if you've had a chance to see the documentary Secret Space.
No, I haven't.
They talk about how, this actually was a conversation about how Wernher von Braun made it very clear that a lot of the craft that they were seeing in the sky, especially during World War II and afterwards, a lot of them are not terrestrial or man-made in appearance. And he made it very, he actually quoted the same line.
I'm not surprised, but I don't know that.
No, I'm just letting you know. And a lot of the German scientists that were working on the real-powered craft, in terms of like UFO-type craft, were actually brought over to the United States under Project Paperclip.
Yeah.
And a lot of them brought under Project Paperclip all worked at JPL and then to create these craft. But NASA says, no, even there's a lot of clips from NASA saying, Houston, we have the, a spacecraft under there. It all has been scrambled since then.
I know that, and NASA is very...
NASA's silly. No, and NASA, and it's very clear that...
One of my good friends, whose name you'll see later on in the series, is a retired NASA human factor scientist.
Yes.
But he can't, nothing official. I mean, he can't do anything official.
No, he can't, but I think there's enough. I mean, if seeing is believing, and if you're asking pilots and astronauts who are supposed to be trained visually to see what they're seeing, and of all these NASA missions, every astronaut has seen, photographed, and filmed UFOs. All of them.
Well, I didn't know that was true of everyone, but I certainly know some have.
Most of them have, and especially Edgar Mitchell.
That I know. I wasn't sure they were all there, but I agree with you.
Check out Secret Space.
No, that's not. Ingrid got that wrong. The next one is basically on more of the UFO.
So basically, your outline for 412 is the close encounter in the impact.
That's right. So the outline is correct.
The outline is correct. There was an error, but we caught it.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
No, but my friend Bud Hopkins says it's a terrible movie.
Is it fictitious, or is it based on a true story?
Well, I think it may have been based on some evidence, but he didn't like it. That's all I know. I haven't seen it myself.
Okay.
So it's not
supposed to be fictitious. It's not real.
It's
not based on a true story.
But it's also, he felt it didn't do the cause any good, put it that way.
Okay.
So I haven't seen it myself.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Will you be talking about the alleged crash of a craft in New Mexico or Arizona together?
I won't, because while that's highly controversial, I don't know who's right. I have no idea.
Yeah.
I know the participants in that debate, but I don't know who's got the right answer.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to talk about that. I'll answer questions about it if anyone wants to ask me, but the answer will be I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I didn't put it in the lecture because I can't say anything about it.
Roswell, that's
moral,
right.
Certainly. Roswell, that's exactly.
New Mexico, right?
Roswell, New Mexico, but I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah.
I really don't.
Can you highlight sightings from other cultures, like not just from Western Europe, North America, which a lot of these things come from? Like, I mean, at some point, or could you highlight astronaut viewings from the space station, those kind of things? Like,
I can.
That would be very different sources than we normally hear. We normally hear about, someone driving down the road and all of a sudden, like, without a Chinese pilot or, something really out of the...
If you want somebody who's not Caucasian, there's a very well-known Japan Airlines sighting, and the pilots were Japanese. And that's fairly recent.
Okay.
But it's definitely not a North European, North American phenomenon.
But it seems to have been very much much more talked about in North America. Or maybe I don't know the other places.
Well, first of all, the only... Yeah,
yeah,
there's
a,
you're right,
yeah.
there's a lot lots of South American sightings. And it's just that my database is more
North American
than European.
And the astronaut sightings you were mentioning, and the space station.
I'm not going to go into those, but some...
Are there some...
There are a few, I'm sure, nowadays, you can find something about almost anything like that.
On the Google it or something. Google, okay.
Yeah, sure. But I don't have any of that included in my own talk, because I'm not as familiar with it as I am with some other stuff.
Other stuff.
That's the only reason.
Okay. Thank you.
I try only to talk about stuff I at least have some confidence
that
in.
That you know.
I know, yeah. And there's lots of stuff.
Okay.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
Don Darren, you said you will be available after for questions.
Yeah.
About the movie?
Are you
right? Yeah, I'm right.
I think you were one of the proponents of this.
Oh, yeah.